An hour for now, Governor Rauner delivers his State of the State address. Last year, we were in the midst of a budget crisis. So what will he say this time? Here he is last year.
We haven't had a full year budget of some kind in a year and a half. And we haven't had a state budget that is truly balanced in decades.
Plus, last summer, President Trump called for a ban on transgender individuals serving in the military.
My heart basically dropped the moment that I read that, because here was the head of the organization that I had spent my whole life being dedicated to, out of the blue, implying that I was going to be thrown out.
That's Lyneth Starr of the Indiana National Guard at the time. Since then, a court ruling has stopped the ban in its tracks. We'll hear how that happened and talk to other transgender veterans about how this issue has affected them. And the Brookfield Zoo is celebrating a big birthday for its oldest animal. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay with us. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Lots going on today with the State of the State address in an hour. We'll have a preview of that coming up to in a little bit. But first, last summer, President Donald Trump tweeted that transgender people should not be allowed to serve in the armed forces. He said, quote, "The enormous medical costs of supporting them cost the military too much money." I should note the RAND Corporation released a study after that showing even at the very most, those medical costs would amount to 0.1% of the Defense Department's budget. The president's tweet, though, triggered multiple lawsuits almost immediately. Sorry, 0.1% of the Defense Department's budget, just to make that clear. The president's tweet triggered multiple lawsuits almost immediately, including from the ACLU. By the end of October, a district court judge had blocked this proposed ban. This means that the military began accepting qualified transgender recruits on January 1st of this year. In the meantime, there are estimates of anywhere from 1,300 to 15,000 current transgender service members, whether in reserve or on active duty. I'm joined now by Elby Leave. She served in the Army on active duty from 2010 to 2014, and she's currently part of the Individual Ready Reserve, one of these 1,300 to 15,000 current transgender service members. She's on the line from Bloomington, Indiana. Hi, Elby. Welcome to the 21st.
Hi, Nyla. How are you?
Good, thank you. Elby, where were you when President Trump first tweeted this proposed ban back in late July of last year?
I was actually standing in my kitchen. I work early in the mornings, and I had gotten home from work, and I saw this. I wasn't following Twitter at the time, but I found it on my Facebook feed. And when I saw it, I was pretty upset, and I broke down crying.
Did you have any guesses on what you think would happen next?
I really wasn't sure. I knew for myself that I came out when I was in the Individual Ready Reserves. I did not come out while I was active duty. And I knew that I was sort of taking a chance at that point in time. But the climate has sort of changed, and that I knew that the VA was providing care for transgender veterans. That's kind of why I came out, and then I saw this, and it was really seemed like a slap in the face, and I really didn't know going forward like what that would mean. And I had friends and stuff that serve in the military currently, both, you know, active duty or in the National Guard and stuff, and it really seemed like a slap in the face, and I really didn't know. It made me feel like a second class citizen.
And LB, to that point, do you feel like you said you made a point of coming out when you were not in active duty, but when you were part of the reserves? How much did you think about the timing of that? How much did that play into your calculus for when you came out?
It actually played quite heavily into it. You hear a lot of stories from trans people. It's, you know, we talk about transition stuff. It's a process for us. And oftentimes it ends in sort of an epiphany. But oftentimes that epiphany, there's a lot of fear around it because you're potentially losing family and friends. You could be jeopardizing your career. And when I was in the military, they had repealed the Don't Ask, Don't Tell. So in my unit, I actually had, there was a I had couples, a lesbian couple that had married and stuff. And it was like very much a different sort of military at that point in time than my impression of what it had been prior. But yet the ban on being transgender or having issues around your gender. They use some antiquated language such as transvestism and things like that, but things have changed and our understanding of it's different or whatever. So I was very concerned because at that point in time, me struggling with my idea of my gender could have led to me being kicked out of the Army, which was something I didn't want to have happen. And then also to how that would impact the rest of my life. So I was very much concerned at that point in time. And so as I was kind of reaching a conclusion as to where I felt like I really needed to go as far as transitioning, coming out, that when I saw that the policy, like under the Obama administration, there has been a change in a directive towards medical care through the VA. And when I saw that, I really realized that, like, and also to the policy.
That was a signal to you, you think, about a cultural shift as well?
Yeah, totally. Yeah, right. And there was, and actually there's kind of a, there's a Staff Sergeant Patricia King, and she recently attended the State of the Union address as Senator Joseph Kennedy's guest. She's an active duty transgender soldier serving in Washington. I forgot the Fort Lewis McChord. And her story, I saw it in it might have been the New York Times or something. But I saw her. I forgot exactly where it was. But I saw her story, and it really resonated with me. And it gave me the courage because she had came out because the policies had changed, and it made me realize like that I could do this too. So
and LB, yeah. Now that you're sort of talking about the cultural shift. Then there was the tweet from President Trump about the medical costs. Again, I should note, I'm sorry, I keep getting the percentage wrong. Let me just say it clearly this time. The Rand Corporation study shows that even at the most, the medical costs would amount to 0.01% of the Defense Department's budget. So there we go, 0.01%.
Right.
And now, of course, there's a D.C. Circuit Court judge that sort of put a stop to this. Where are things at right now? Do you feel that transgender recruits can enlist? Are you worried that transgender service members might be feeling they're worried about being discriminated against, being banned? What do you think the climate is like right now?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really good point. Because, well, the way I understand it, too, the judge basically said that, you know, that this presidential, I forget what, directive or whatever that President Trump was trying to put out couldn't go forward or whatever. And basically she just moved it back to the status quo. So that the policy that had been set in place or whatever for allowing transgender soldiers to, you know, to move into the, or to be in the military and to enlist and stuff just basically got put back to where it was supposed to, the way it was progressing. My sense of climate, I do have a friend that is currently in the Indiana National Guard, and they're going through transition. And the impression I got from them, as far as the people in their unit and stuff, that there isn't really an issue, you know. But they were already sort of in, you know. And it is a little bit. You do have to kind of jump through hoops with this process, you know. And if you've ever dealt with anything in the military, you know, there's always rules and there's always a process of how you're supposed to do things. And there's always people, you know, watching that happen and making sure that things happen the right way. But as far as my sense of it, like just kind of the openness in the unit that I was in, as far as accepting, you know, gay and lesbian folks or whatever, I didn't really see a lot of negativity. Now that can change from unit to unit. So, but my sense of it is, going to basic is kind of scary in and of itself. And I'm not, I would like to hope that there would be a certain amount of openness and acceptance of folks, you know, joining as trans people. And perhaps if they've already transitioned and then join, or if they're transitioning in the military, you know, there's a process in place or whatever. And the military, for the most part, is pretty good about following the policies, you know.
And it sounds like for you, you also had an environment where you felt like people were very open. LB, I wanted to bring a couple more people into this conversation.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Kathleen Robbins is in studio with me, a former Air Force officer. Hi, Kathleen.
Hi,
welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being here. Ed Yonka is also with us, Communications and Policy Director for the ACLU of Illinois. Ed, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here, too.
Oh, what a! This is a great discussion to join, and that was really quite a powerful bit of testimony there.
Ed, can I ask you from a legal standpoint, what's been the core argument that's been held up here? What did the circuit court say?
Yeah. So there have actually been three courts that have looked at this question and all fundamentally held that the ban that the president is advancing is unconstitutional, and largely on the basis of both not permitting gender discrimination. And what we see increasingly is courts making the argument that the sex discrimination statutes in our federal law include those people who are transgender, and so therefore one can't discriminate against somebody based on their gender if in fact part of that is them living out their true gender. And the second issue that's been identified largely in the courts is the fact that people are being asked to, are being refused the ability to enlist if, in fact, they've transitioned, which often can lead or result from them having to identify themselves or out themselves for having done that, and that is has been ruled a violation of a Fifth Amendment right against giving information against oneself. And so, those have been essentially the two arguments that have been made. The government has tried, I'll just say the Department of Defense has tried to make some other arguments that frankly just have not withstood any kind of scrutiny. But those have really been the core arguments in the litigation thus far.
So those are the legal arguments. Kathleen, I wanted to ask you more of a cultural question. You served in Vietnam. You came out as a trans woman in 1990. I wonder, as we were talking to LBE, someone who's in active duty, I wonder how you sort of feel about when President Trump tweeted that last year. I think there are a lot of people who are wondering how this would affect them. But I can't help but think of what one of our senators, Tammy Duckworth, said last August. She said that when she was bleeding to death, this is what she said: "I was bleeding to death in my Black Hawk helicopter after I was shot down. I didn't care if the American troops risking their lives to help save me were gay, straight, transgender, black, white, or brown. All that mattered was that they didn't leave me behind." Do you think that, Kathleen, that's a common sentiment that Senator
and the military Duckworth said, "Amen." Yes, all you care about is who has your back, and that's flying in combat in Vietnam. I was worried about whether my other crewmates were going to do their jobs, and they always did. And it was always, everybody was working towards one goal.
And so that's while you're in combat, while you are maybe not in the U.S., do you think that things are a little bit different nowadays or when you're out, when you're maybe not serving in combat together?
Well, all I can say is for today, I'm an Air Force Academy grad, and I went back in 2010 before Don't Ask, Don't Tell ended and before all the controversy about trans. And I've had nothing but good experiences. People have been great acceptance. When Don't Ask, Don't Tell ended, like LB said, it was a non-event. People just went on with their, and most people said, "Well, we knew anyway with who the gays and lesbians in the culture." Now, I might say that from a legal standpoint, I know of an Air Force Academy graduate in 2017 and a West Point, and neither of them were commissioned. We spent hundreds of thousands of dollars training them, and then the Trump administration chose not to commission them.
I guess I wonder, do you think that President Trump's tweet has become a non-event, or how would you view it now?
I think it's still a big event. Then on January 18th, the Department of Health and Human Services, the Office of Civil Rights, opened the Conscious and Religious Freedom Division, which basically allows people to discriminate against other people because of their, quote, sincerely held religious beliefs. And I think that's going to be the next frontier. I'd be interested in what the ACLU has to say about that.
We just have about a minute or two left. Ed, do you wonder if you wanted to weigh in?
Yeah, I think there's, let me say two things. First of all, I think that Kathleen is exactly right that this administration's efforts, to advance so-called religious freedom and liberty is really about trying to give people cover for discrimination. And I do think that will be a huge issue we will be discussing, over the next several years. I think in this particular instance, too, it is absolutely right, as was pointed out, that the government and the Department of Defense under the Trump administration continues to challenge these court rulings holding these policies to be unconstitutional. So I think this is still a big deal because I think they're still pursuing it, and I think they're going to continue to show this as a as an effort that they want to continue and to push forward. And so I think that means that we're going to be dealing with this for a while.
And I think also that people are forgetting that the Secretary Mattis charged the Defense Department to review the Obama administration's policy last July, and that report will be coming out in February sometime. And whether it coincides with the Rand report or something like this, conscience and religious freedom, is an open question right now.
I think that's right. And this reference that Kathleen makes to the Rand report is really critical because, in the Obama administration, they commissioned this report to look, in fact, at the impact that having troops who were transgender serve in units,
afraid I'm going to have to stop you there
because it didn't have any. Yep,
right, we're out of time. But thank you for that. Thanks for all of you for being with me. You're listening to The 21st. Welcome back to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're about 40 minutes out from Governor Rauner's fourth State of the State address. And in this campaign season, could this be his last? That surely got to be on his mind as he delivers the address today, which, of course, I should note, will be carried live on this public radio station right after the conclusion of our program. Joining us now for some analysis about what we may expect to hear from Governor Rauner is Chris Mooney. He's a state politics professor at the University of Illinois Chicago. He's the former director of the Institute for Government and Public Affairs. Hi, Chris. Welcome back to The 21st.
Thanks, Nyla. Glad to be here.
Chris, so coming off the heels of last night's State of the Union address, I wonder how much attention people in Illinois will be paying to the State of the State address. And maybe you can just start by telling us what's supposed to be the point of the State of the State address.
Well, the State of the State address, like the State of the Union, is ostensibly a way for the chief executive to communicate formally to the legislative branch what he or she thinks should be the priorities going forward. First of all, this is what's going on in this particular, it's a state or the nation. Here's how things are, and here's how I suggest that we move forward and, policy proposals and whatnot. So that's what it's all about in general. It's a tradition. It's enshrined in the Constitution for the president. But it has evolved over the years, especially with TV. I mean, there was a time when they didn't even do this thing in person because there was no TV, right? But now there's TV. And since that, since the last 70 years or so that we've had TV, chief executives have used this as a very unique moment where they can get the full attention, if not of the whole nation or state, or at least of the media and the chattering classes, and tout his or her accomplishments and put forward an agenda going forward. And, you know, that's what they typically are today, as we saw last night with the president.
And so with the governor today, the Chicago Tribune's preview of his speech said he plans to issue a bipartisan call to lawmakers. The Tribune pointed out that's just 2 days after calling Democratic House Speaker Michael Madigan a, quote, crook during a campaign forum. So a bit of a mixed message here. Is that a bit some of the crux of the problem of what the governor faces?
Well, yeah, I mean, that arises from his generic strategy of governing and campaigning, blaming Speaker Madigan for everything that's gone on in the state for, you know, the last 40 years or something, and all the problems that we have today.
I should point out how long he's held office for, Chris, Speaker Madigan.
Madigan, that's yes. Right. That's right, yes, because he's been more or less around about 40 years. And, you know, the governor is very consistent on that message. Almost the only thing he says is, it's Mike Madigan's fault anymore. The Tribune editorial board meeting with the governor and Representative Jeannie Ives, who's running against him in the primary, really was stark in that sense, that he, even in a situation as the incumbent who has the responsibility of chief executive, he is consistently blaming over and over again Mike Madigan. And, you know, I don't know how many times his name popped up in that discussion, but it was many times. And he's been doing this for a long time. It's almost gotten to the point where he doesn't really have anything else to say, it seems. And, you know, there's strong value in a leader or in a candidate staying on message. Because if you get muddled and you make your message, you know, Donald Trump's a good example of that. He'll have one message, and then the next day he tweets something and everybody gets confused, it gets distracted. That's not really Rauner's fault, or problem. His problem is that he's gone too much in that direction. He just says the same thing and doesn't respond to questions or to events in any other way. And so that's become kind of a caricature of him at this point, I think.
So, Chris, today he has an opportunity for, you know, half an hour, 45 minutes or so, or however long it will go, to just discuss his vision for the state, his vision for this year. There was a little op-ed that I read this morning that he wrote in the State Journal Register that probably gives us a sense of the tone of what he hopes to strike today. He talked about what a great project we are as a state, the state's legacy in our bicentennial year. He was very upbeat. Do you expect his tone to also be like that, upbeat today, in contrast to what you, you know, to what we've been talking about?
Well, I would, you know, the most salient point about this particular state of the state speech for Rauner is that he's running for re-election. And so in a re-election year, you know, the script for the governor is to say how great things are going. Here's a bunch of stuff that I did that was great, and everything is good. Now, we still have some problems, but we're carrying on. And basically to get out all the accomplishments and again, not everybody's watching the State Speech, but you guys are in the media, and you will report this. And, you know, people who are thinking about, you know, primary voters and people who's thinking about who they should support in the primary with more than just votes sometimes are looking at this too. And so this is normally what would happen. The problem for the governor is that he doesn't really have a lot of accomplishments to tout at this point in his administration. The most obvious event during his administration has been, you know, the unprecedented, massively damaging government, you know, budget crisis that we had for 2 years. You know, an unprecedented situation. Nobody's ever seen anything like it. We're going to be paying for it for many years down the road, decades down the road, probably because of the sort of backlog of debts. And, you know, the governor has tried to blame others for this, but in the end, the chief executive has to wear the collar for the general functioning of state government. And that's, you know, that's how voters look at that. I mean, they look at, you know, when they vote for governor, a big part of it is just how the general economy is doing, which the governor has really not that much to do with. So the governor is either, you know, unfairly blamed or unfairly gets credit for the economy, depending on how it's going. they also look at, you know, the national, I mean, the national, the president. That's
right, and
the,
sort
factor.
Of the tone of that. Yeah. I'm speaking with Chris Mooney. He teaches state politics at UIC. We're kind of talking ahead of the governor's State of the State address, which is scheduled for noon. By the way, if you have questions or comments about what you think the state of Illinois is, you can always give us a call. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-9455. You can also tweet to 21STShow. I bring that up, Chris, because we've been asking our listeners questions on Facebook to pose for people running for governor as we're doing our candidate interviews. And I wanted to mention something. There are a couple issues that people brought up on Facebook of issues they want to deal with around the state. Julie was wondering about pensions, and she was wondering what candidates are going to be doing to ensure that state employees receive the pensions they've earned. Can you remind us of the pension problem that we're facing as a state, Chris?
Yeah, that is and remains just a massive debt that we owe. I think the last estimate I saw is about $120 billion. Of course, it's not $120 billion we've got to pay tomorrow, but it, you know, over the course of the next 20, 30, 40 years that we have to pay. And that's money that's owed to current and former state and other local government employees whom – you know, who have entered into a contract and done their work and they're owed this money. The state constitution, as strongly supported by the state Supreme Court, holds that that money is sacrosanct, that money will be paid regardless of anything else. It's a contract that cannot be broken except by mutual agreement, and that doesn't seem to be forthcoming from the employee side anytime soon. There's no reason why they should, because they've earned the money and the Constitution says they should get it. So why are they going to give something up, right? So I think Julie, if she's a pensioner or going to be, if she's in a tier one system in the state, she's going to get the money that she has worked for and contracted for is entitled to. The problem is the state's got to figure out, the problem is that the state has obligated too much money and failed to keep that money. I mean, basically, every paycheck, a state employee's part of their salary goes into the pension. They've got to kick in sort of 7-8% of their paycheck, and supposedly the state's doing the same thing. But while the workers have been taken out of their check every time, the state has failed to save the money, and so we've basically been spending money on services and programs and other things, or tax cuts that we've obligated, and we've you know, when somebody works, we owe them that money, and now we haven't saved it up. Now we're stuck holding the bill after, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50 years of doing this, and you know, so that's a problem that is beyond the general budget problem that the governor's got right now.
It's a problem, Chris, that's probably been a bit neglected for the past couple of years because of the immediate budget crisis. I feel like it's something
exactly.
That's been again pushed to the back burner. We're talking about
your house is burning down. When your house is burning down, you forget that you maxed out on your credit card. So that's what we're doing here.
Yeah. We're talking about the state of Illinois ahead of the State of the State address. If you have questions or comments, want to weigh in, our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. Chris, we had another comment on Facebook that I wanted to bring up too. And Roy said that he thought Illinois politics has been a disaster for a while. And he wonders what we can do to turn this around. He says, jobs are leaving along with hordes of people. Taxes are out of sight and getting worse. What can you do about it? As we think about the current state that we're in for Illinois, we've mentioned pensions. We mentioned a little bit of the backlog of bills that we have faced over not having a budget for the past 2 years. I don't know what you think Governor Rauner is going to say in terms of if he's even going to address these sorts of things in the state of the street. What kind of solutions do you think, or what kind of discussions do you think we need to be having right now in terms of fixing these very big issues we're facing as a state?
Well, I mean, you've got multiple. I mean, from what I'm hearing from Roy, from his comment, it sounds like he's more concerned with the political crisis, which, of course, exacerbates the budget crisis, and which all of that, both of those things probably have an impact on things like whether companies decide to expand or move here and so forth, as sort of, you know, the business climate. So
right, which we have seen. Right.
Yes. Well, and you know, part of that, it's a bit of an open question. Yes, there, you know, people come and go from states. People always come and go from states. The state of Illinois is losing population. We're not unique in that, in the sense that, you know, the upper Midwest has for a long time had this, and people are draining down to the South. They want to go where it's warm, especially this time of year. Now that we've got air conditioning, it's not such a problem to live in Arizona or in Florida. So there's that going on. And so there's these macro level economic forces at work. But certainly on the margin, you know, a state government that appears to the public to be as dysfunctional as it appears to be, as sort of over the last 15 years in this state, where we've got, you know, high profile corruption at the highest level in the state. And then we have, with the current administration, just, you know, sort of amazingly bad problems that nobody ever thought we would have before in terms of the budget shutdown, which, you know, often, you know, to some extent seems like a self-inflicted wound. And the failure then to address the general problems that led to that. I think, you know, if I knew how to fix this, then I'd be running for governor. I don't know that the gubernatorial candidates necessarily know how to fix this. I think these are broad systemic problems. But one thing that's probably needed is for a reduction in the sort of polarization in the politics. People are just yelling too loud. And that's at the national level, even in, you know, more so than at the state level. But when you've got, you know, for example, the governor and the speaker is kind of low-key and keeps his, you know, own counsel on a lot of these things, so we can't say he's out there railing against Rauner in the way Rauner's railing against him. But that kind of, when you've got two of the sort of three major leaders in the policymaking process, the other one being the Senate, the president, you know, going at each other in such a vicious and really personal way that the governor is taking out, calling them corrupt, you know, both the Senate president and the speaker. Now, you know, whether they are or not, it depends on your version of definition of corruption, depends on the facts of the case. They've certainly never been charged with anything. They've certainly never been, you know, there's never been a hint of scandal, sort of legally. But just the fact that this sort of discussion is going on among the people that have to solve these really, really difficult problems makes me concerned for the ability to do that, right? I mean, you know, the first thing you have to do is we got hard problems. We got bad things that need to be solved. And, you know, jacking up the rhetoric 100 degrees is probably not the best way to do this. It may help in the campaign, but it's not going to help when they've got to really sit down across the table and work things out.
Chris, we've got less than a minute left, but to that end, I just wanted to ask you about the Democratic response, your point about rhetoric. It's going to be delivered by Lou Lange, a state representative from Illinois' 16th House District, Skokie, Chicago's North Side. Who gets picked for this? Do we expect that he's going to ratchet back the rhetoric back, or maybe we'll...
No, I don't think so. I think, you know, Lou Lange is a very strong liberal. He's from Skokie. He's been around a long time. He himself was exploring running for governor at one point, didn't quite pan out. He is a medical lieutenant for a long time and a very liberal guy and very outspoken, very articulate. He's not going to... I would suspect, I'm just guessing anyway here,
all right,
that he's not going to pacify.
Chris, thanks for joining us for a little bit of analysis ahead of the State of the State Address, which will begin at noon. Chris Mooney teaches state politics at UIC. He's also former director of the University of Illinois Institute of Government and Public Affairs. Hey, Chris, thanks for being with me.
My pleasure, Nyla. Have a good day.
You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. As we were just talking about, there are lots of people hoping to become not just our next governor, but also our next attorney general. And for the next couple of weeks, we're going to be playing our interviews with the candidates. And we're starting with attorney general. There are 8 Democrats and 2 Republicans in the race for the office currently held by Lisa Madigan. The primary is on March 20th. Here's how this works. We asked all of the candidates more or less the same questions like a job interview. And we also recorded these in advance to give no one an unfair an advantage. And they're going to air in random order over the next few weeks. Today, we're starting with Gary Grasso. He's the former mayor of the southwest Chicago suburb of Burr Ridge. He's currently on the DuPage County Board, and he's one of 2 Republican candidates running for attorney general. His opponent is Erica Harold. Gary Grasso, welcome to the 21st.
Oh, thank you, Nyla. I appreciate the opportunity to speak on my candidacy.
Now, you've been an attorney for more than 3 decades, a litigator to be specific. Why do you want to be attorney general?
Well, the attorney general, think about the job this way. It is the acronym ALL, A-L-L. The job of the attorney general of the state of Illinois is to advocate, legislate, that is to suggest remedial legislation to the legislature, and primarily is litigation. The attorney general is the litigator for the people of the state of Illinois. And therefore, and it's an office with over 350 attorneys and an equal number of staff. So that person has to have the right experience. I believe I have that because I have been a litigator for over 3 decades. In fact, I'm almost into my 4th decade. And I've been in court and handled probably 400 to 500 cases on my own as lead counsel for all of this time. I have tried lawsuits. I have argued appeals. I've handled countless depositions. In fact, in the last 3 months, I have handled 30 depositions on my own in a case that I have going on. So I have deep experience as a litigator, and I believe my opponent has very little actual litigation experience. On the public service side and administrative side, as you pointed out, I've been a mayor for 8 years. If anybody's been to Burr Ridge, we transformed that village. I did with a lot of help from a lot of other people during some of the worst economic times that we've had, and at no taxpayer cost. We also built a new police station. I also have helped have the bridge over I-55, the first branded bridge. As a litigator, by the way, I wanted to get back to something because of the types of cases I've handled. I should have mentioned this. I've handled all kinds for plaintiffs and defendants, commercial litigation, medical malpractice cases, professional liability cases, accounting cases, landlord-tenant cases, a wide variety of litigation. So I also bring that experience too. But also on my public service side. Now I'm on the DuPage County Board. I went there in 2012, was elected as a sitting mayor, gave up my seat as mayor, went on to the county board. And one of the things I'm most proud of there, and one of the other reasons I'm really running for attorney general, is to root out corruption, public corruption. The office of the attorney general has to focus on public corruption now. And also the opioid problems in Illinois.
Well, you mentioned litigation, and I wanted to ask you about that because we've certainly seen Lisa Madigan be very active in the past year, joining other attorneys general and suing the Trump administration. Do you think part of the role of attorney general is to take on the federal government?
Not to take on the federal government. I don't believe so. I think in the right circumstance, you have to analyze all kinds of the reason. I'm not quite sure that I agree with the role she has pursued. I will tell you what I disagree with her about and what's more important to me at this point, and that is the opioid litigation, which she has not jumped into. Opioid addiction, heroin addiction, is affecting all families across Illinois. The state's attorneys in several of the collar counties of Chicago and also in, I believe, Winnebago and other counties, all got together and instituted and joined the lawsuits that have already happened. And the attorney general has not, and I believe the attorney general should have. And that's where I believe you need to be active, where it affects the welfare of the people of Illinois.
What else would you do then in terms of the opioid epidemic? What kind of litigation would you be pursuing?
Well, I'd be joining what is already in progress, and no point in reinventing the wheel there, going after the drug manufacturers, the distributors, and those in the medical community that have improperly overprescribed these drugs. Importantly, the perspective that I'm going to bring to this that I think is very crucial is you need to also look at the end game. Part of my public service background is that I've been on the DuPage County Board of Health for 12 years. Now, that's only relevant because I was there when the tobacco settlement occurred. And although hundreds of millions of dollars came into Illinois and many other states as a result of it, none or almost none of that money was directed to health care in Illinois, just went into the general fund. That is wrong. What will happen when I'm attorney general and we're involved in the opioid litigation and when we get our hands on all of those monies, which are projected to be more than the tobacco settlement, is that they will go for the health and welfare of all the families and people that have been affected in this state. I will make sure of that, that it goes for treatment, it goes for education, it goes for rebuilding these lives and preventing others from getting on these drugs.
Your opponent received the endorsement of the Republican Party, most Republicans in Congress, and party leaders in Illinois, including Jim Durkin and, of course, Governor Bruce Rauner. Why should primary voters choose you instead?
Because the primary voters should have choice. The governor doesn't get to pick the attorney general. You have to look at the qualifications, and I deeply believe, and that's why I got into this race, that while I highly respect my opponent and respect the things that she's done, she really has not any deep litigation experience. I don't believe, if you ask her, she's ever tried a lawsuit. If she's never tried a lawsuit, how can she even put herself out there as the chief litigator for the state of Illinois? She describes herself on her website as an emerging attorney in 2017. She has she just hasn't had the experience. And so I believe the voters of Illinois should have a choice to pick the person with the best credentials and the best track record. I also have that track record on the administrative side, and my opponent hasn't been elected or even appointed to any office.
From DuPage County in Burr Ridge, Gary Grosso is the former mayor, currently on the DuPage County Board, and a Republican candidate for Attorney General. Thank you for being with me.
Thank you, Nyla. I appreciate the opportunity.
This month was a special one at the Brookfield Zoo. Their oldest animal, Ramar, the gorilla, turned 50. He has been at the zoo since 1998. He's actually one of the oldest gorillas in the country. To mark the occasion properly, the animal care staff at the zoo gave Ramar a frozen cake filled with bananas, apples, pineapples, and raisins, and topped with frozen blueberries and yogurt frosting. If that wasn't enough, he also enjoyed banana leaves, which are one of his favorite treats. We're joined on the line now by Amy Roberts. She's the curator of mammals at the Brookfield Zoo. Hi, Amy. Welcome to the 21st.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Can you tell us a little bit about Ramar? Amy, what's he like?
He's a very good gorilla, has some close relationships with his animal care staff, and seems to be enjoying his kind of golden years or his retirement here at the zoo.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that because he was already 30 when he came to the zoo in 1998.
Correct.
Do we know anything about his early life? Where was he?
For his first 7 years, he was born in Africa, and for the first 7 years of his life, he was held by a family who then decided to give him up and to put him into professional care at a zoo, and he was living at a couple of different zoos before he came to us. So we don't know his exact birth date, but we do know that it was either late fall or early winter. So we've always just celebrated his birthday in January.
And what kind of gorilla is Ramar?
He is a Western lowland gorilla, and they are considered critically endangered.
And so is he also unusual in the sense that he's 50 years old?
Yeah, he is the seventh oldest overall within North American accredited institutions and the third oldest male at this time.
And so in terms of gorilla years, he's kind of a grandpa, right? And I understand he's dealing with some issues that older folks deal with, like degenerative arthritis and knee pain. What kind of things do you do to help keep him in as good health as he can be at this age?
Well, we have an absolutely fantastic veterinary care team here, and they've been caring for him for years. And in the last couple of years, they've also been reaching out to human orthopedic surgeons. So he has had some procedures done on his knees, very similar to what a human would have done on their own knees to increase comfort and flexibility. And his keepers also train him, and some of the enrichment that he has encourages him to stretch. So it's kind of like physical therapy that we can help him with to try to keep him as mobile and as comfortable as possible.
Does the cold bother him? I imagine with his arthritis, is that tougher?
No, the area, you know, has a wonderful heating system, so he doesn't really feel the impact of that we would if we're going inside and outside.
Okay. And he, as I mentioned, he was pretty old already when he got to the zoo. Has his personality changed? He's got lots of family at the zoo as well, right?
Yeah, he's fathered three offspring here, and one of those offspring, Kamba, still lives here with what would be Ramar's grandson, Zachary. And I guess over the years, he's just slowed down.
And so does he have much social interaction with the other gorillas?
He can hear them and talk with them, but he mainly, his strongest relationships right now are with his animal care specialists, the keepers that are caring for him on a daily basis.
And how often is he interacting with them then?
Oh, multiple times throughout the day, as far as the keepers. And then from the evening all through the next morning when he goes back out into his habitat, he has visual and auditory communication with the family group that he lives adjacent to.
I'm speaking with Amy Roberts. She's a curator of mammals at Brookfield Zoo. Amy, what's your favorite thing about Ramar?
I just like the way that he is living out his golden years in as much comfort as we can give him, and what a good relationship he has with his keepers.
And how did you guys come up with the cake?
Our animal care specialists are phenomenally creative with our zoo nutrition department, and we make cakes for lots of the animals. So you just look at what their favorite foods are, and then we figure out a way to make that kind of look like a human birthday cake. But he did prefer his banana leaves as opposed to the cake that our keepers put great effort into creating for him.
Yeah, that's probably more for the humans than for him, right?
Yeah, pretty much. I believe that's the case.
We've been talking about the oldest gorilla at the zoo. What about the youngest animals that you have at Brookfield Zoo?
Well, our youngest gorilla is Zachary, who, as I said, is Ramar's grandson. And I'm trying to think of, well, we also have, within the same primate department, within our Tropic World habitat, we have baby colobus monkeys, baby black manga bees, young squirrel monkeys. So we have a pretty active breeding program here and a cooperative breeding program with other accredited institutions.
And is January, because you have a breeding program, is there a way to schedule the times of the birth, or does that just kind of happen all year and you guys don't really have much control over that?
With certain species, we do try to time it so that they're born in the spring so that they get to enjoy a full summer season outside when we have a lot of guest visitation here. But then there's other certain animals that they're just seasonal breeders, so we don't really have much control over that. And with the gorillas, we don't really time their births. We just let them decide when it's time.
And Ramar is 50, as we said this year, one of the oldest gorillas in the country at the Brookfield Zoo. I want to thank Amy Roberts, curator of mammals, for joining us to help us learn a little bit more about Ramar. Thanks, Amy.
Oh, thank you so much.
That's that's all the time we have for today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. If we have Alexa, by the way, we're easy to find. You have to have NPR One enabled, but you just say to Alexa, ask NPR One to play The 21st. All of those links, directions for Alexa, every other way to contact us. If you want to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, follow us on social media. All you have to remember is our website, 21stshow.org. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio. Grace Stetson is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.